Okay, well, welcome everyone. I'm just going to get started here. If more people come, they can pick up or can listen on the internet, as these talks will be available in MP3. So last week I was talking about wisdom and how the essence of Buddhism is wisdom, the highest virtue. Or the main goal of Buddhism is to become wise, to understand the nature of reality, the nature of ourselves, the way experience and existence works. And so this week I thought I'd stick on the same sort of theme and keep it very practical, but talk about those sort of things that the Lord Buddha said are useful, helpful, or supportive in the development and the attainment of wisdom. And in this case, the Lord Buddha was talking specifically about right view. But really the meaning of what we call right view is wisdom. The essence, the core of wisdom is right view or right understanding. Looking at things in the right way and seeing them as they are. Not seeing things to be something else. And the common example is when we step on a rope in a dark room and scream and jump up because we think it's a snake. This is the example that they give in the ancient texts, and it's something that probably most of us have experienced at some point in our life, where either in this case or in something very similar, you see something not for what it is, and so you react inappropriately. And the teachings of the Buddha explain that actually this is how we live a lot of our lives. We experience things not as they are. We receive and interpret things to be something other than what they are or more than they are. And so as a result, we react inappropriately and we give rise to all sorts of inappropriate actions and behaviors that cause suffering for ourselves or suffering for other people. So one thing that's important to keep in mind in regards to this is that what we mean by right view and what we mean by wisdom and what we mean by the correct interpretation, etc., etc., all has to do with suffering and happiness. So there's no dogmatism or strict adherence to a certain dogma or certain religious belief. We're simply talking about something that everyone should be able to agree upon, that if it brings suffering, it should be considered inappropriate or bad. If it brings happiness, it should be considered good. And our biggest problem is not that we don't all want for happiness and try to act in ways that bring about happiness. The problem is that we don't understand those things that will bring us happiness. We don't understand how to react. We react inappropriately. We want happiness, but we react in a way that brings us suffering. So we can understand that all of Buddhism is simply for this purpose, to bring about right view, to bring about right understanding of things. Now, what I wanted to talk about today is not specifically right view, but to talk about those things which aid in the attainment of right view and right understanding. And so the Buddha said there are five of them. These five, in the order that they're given, in the order of attainment generally, are morality, learning or study, conversation, tranquility, and insight. And so this is what I'm just going to give some time to talk about, and then hopefully at the end we can have a chance to sit together for a short time, and then I'll take questions until everyone has had enough. These are also five good things. One of the reasons I wanted to talk about these is because they're five good things that we should keep in mind if we're interested in practicing meditation. A very simple way to put it is, you know, we're trying to keep up a daily or a regular meditation practice. What are those things that we have to keep in mind and we have to develop and we have to take into consideration if we want our meditation to succeed. So these are five good things, very practical, it's not just theoretical. The first one is morality, and this is always very important in talking about the Buddha's teaching, and it's often something that's overlooked by people who come for the first time to practice meditation. They had no idea that meditation had to come with rules or had to come with morality. I think of meditation as something you don't have to be anything to. They understand you don't have to be Buddhist or you don't have to be this or that to practice meditation, and so they think rules of morality should not be necessary, because they would be specific to certain belief systems or certain religions. But the point here, as we're talking about, is we're trying to bring about clarity and understanding. And the idea is that there are certain actions, certain behaviors, which are going to be contrary to that. A very good example is drinking alcohol, for instance. Many people think that not drinking alcohol is simply a purist or a religious zealot or a goody-goody way of looking at things, that actually there's nothing wrong with drinking alcohol or taking intoxicants. But it's very clear from a meditation point of view that you're going in two opposite directions if you think that you can do both at once, if you think you can intoxicate your mind and clear your mind at the same time. And so this is a very important rule as an example. And there are other rules. The first part of morality is simply keeping rules. And we generally take these up upon ourselves as promises to ourselves, not to any god or any religious leader, but we make a determination in ourselves. I undertake to practice in this way, to avoid this or to avoid that, to abstain from this and to abstain from that. And so often we come to believe that simply making that determination is to be moral. And of course, that's where it becomes a religious thing and not a very practical thing. Because on a practical point of view, we're just not, the point is not to do these things. And you could say you're going to practice meditation without taking any rules on yourself. If, you know, often people have a problem with keeping rules or having sets of rules or commandments or so on. I mean, the point is just don't do these things. And we point them out to people because if you're still doing these, if you're involved in these things, it's going to be very difficult for you to clear your mind. That's really the only point. But as a tradition, we generally do take these as a set of rules, and it makes it a lot easier to remember what sorts of things are going to get in the way. Not to kill is one. Killing is something which destroys the mind. There's a very good book which most people have heard of or you know, is very famous in the world, A Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky, I think. And it shows how, you know, even when you haven't been accused of a crime that you've committed, when no one knows that you've done something wrong, you know, and there's no getting out of that. There's no escaping your own guilt when you've done something. We often think things like killing is, you know, if you can get away with it, you just forget about it. And the truth is you can't. Yeah, not stealing, not cheating on others. So in relationships, people think, you know, cheating is, you know, in some societies it's very accepted by the people who do it anyway. Not lying, not trying to deceive others. These are things which, in general, are going to have repercussions, or absolutely have repercussions. And will have repercussions in the progress of your meditation practice. But another part of morality is simply to guard your senses. So, for instance, not looking at beautiful things and creating lust or attraction to beautiful things, or beautiful sounds, or smells, or tastes. To not become intoxicated with sensual experience. So instead of watching movies all the time or listening to music all the time, to try and keep your mind clear and to keep your mind unintoxicated. Because in the same way that drugs create addiction and give this state of intoxication to the mind, so too do the chemicals in the mind, the chemicals that are already present in our brains. And the process of addiction, the process of attraction, can have a very similar effect. It makes you feel really good, but then it makes you want it more, and it clouds the mind. It keeps our mind from being clear. It keeps us from being truly happy and at peace, because we're always chasing after things. So morality isn't just keeping rules. It's keeping the mind from wandering, or keeping the mind clear, keeping the mind from falling off the path, pulling the mind back, and keeping it with simple and bare awareness, or clear awareness of reality. There are other parts of morality as well that we often talk about. For instance, your livelihood. Nowadays people are content to take any job that they can. So often it seems kind of difficult to be picky or choosy, but there are certain types of livelihood that we should think, even though this does bring me money or makes me wealthy or so on, it's going to have serious repercussions on my state of mental health or spiritual advancement, so that we should stay away from basically any kind of livelihood that has to do with breaking the precepts, but also those kind of buying and selling that have to do with breaking the precepts. For instance, buying and selling weapons, selling alcohol, for instance, selling human beings, selling live animals to be killed or so on. Any kind of livelihood that has to do with selling poison, selling traps, all of this. And of course, any livelihood where you have to lie, where you have to steal, or you have to do this or do inappropriate things. We should stay away from those. And the final part of morality is to be careful, or have care in regards to our possessions, in regards to the things which we keep. This is one. I mean, these are actually, all accessory things that, when you're meditating, of course, you don't have to think about. But if you want your meditation to succeed in terms of your daily life and the way you live your lives, if you want the way you live your lives to be meditative, you have to be careful. You have to think, these things that I have, are they really necessary? Am I using them for a good purpose? Am I using them for their purpose, or am I buying and obtaining things simply for my own? Addiction, to feed my own addictions, to feed my own attachments, or to feed the attachments of others in terms of buying beautiful clothes or jewelry or so on, buying luxury cars or big houses or iPhones or so on. No. I mean, if you're using things for their purpose, then of course there's no problem in having things if you understand and see clearly their purpose. But when you start to use them simply for your own, and to feed your own addictions, and simply for the pleasure that they bring when they're there, and that they fail to bring when they're not there, then you're probably going to have difficulty. That they're always going to be a source of distraction, and create a distracted state of mind. So these are good things to keep in mind, at the very least, the basic sense of morality in the practice of meditation. Of course, for people who come and meditate, they give up all of these things when they undertake meditation courses. They'll often refrain from eating. They'll eat only one time a day. So we don't stop, we don't fast. But as for myself, for many years, I've only eaten in the morning. I eat one meal a day, basically. They'll sleep on the floor. They'll wear white clothes, or wear rags, for instance. What monks wear, monks will wear robes which have been spoiled, or have been thrown away, and they sew them together simply for the purpose of keeping warm, or of covering the body. So this is the first important thing. This is going to be very important as a basic practice before we even start to meditate, and throughout our whole meditation career. The second one is suttangs, which means learning or study. So, for instance, coming to listen to a talk. Suttang means to listen, or listening, having listened. And This is, of course, the beginning of everything. It comes, you could say, even before morality, because you have to hear about morality. You have to hear about meditation. Now, often people who meditate on their own will become very afraid and will have a difficult time advancing because they come upon something which they haven't a clue how to deal with. They don't understand, they don't know how to react to, how to deal with. And so it's invaluable for us to spend the times, to take some time out of our daily lives to listen to talks or to read books, to try and seek out wisdom and seek out understanding, to seek out a teacher who can give us explanations. The best is, of course, to seek out the Buddha, to go back and find out what is it that the Buddha taught. And we have texts, huge texts, volumes of the Buddha's teachings available. And when we read them, it gives us an understanding of the framework for our meditation, how to frame our meditation. And anything that arises, we'll then be able to see what it is, we'll be able to understand it in terms of the teaching of the Buddha, who was, you could say, the world's greatest meditation instructor. The third one is similar to the number two. The second one is listening. The third one is conversation. And this one, I think, I wanted to stress more than listening, because I think many people are familiar with the idea of reading books and listening to talks, going to hear lectures, and so on. But I find it rare to see meditators who actually engage in daily dialogue with a teacher. And so often we have people meditating at home, or they go to a monastery and they meditate in silence for weeks and weeks and or years and years. But the Buddha was fairly clear that conversation is important. It's important to have conversation with your teacher so that you can ask questions and so they can speak directly to you, not just you're listening to a talk that is designed for a general audience, as many of the Buddha's talks were, and of course all of my talks are. But that you also have a chance to interact and a chance for the teacher to say to you, look, you have to improve in this way, or you have to remove this from your practice, you have to change this, you have to stop doing that, and so on. You have to adjust this, because the teacher can give you direct advice. And so you can ask questions. You can say, if this comes up, what do I do? Or I'm having this problem. And the teacher can say, this is how you deal with that. This is how you improve it on that. This is how you clear that up. Or this is what this means. They're able to explain things in a way that allows you to improve incredibly, on an incredibly more accelerated, at a more incredibly more accelerated pace than you would ever achieve on your own. It's like considering comparing a person who, without a mirror, can't see their own face, and so they can't tell whether their face is clean or their face is dirty. Another good comparison is when we shave our heads, as the monks will shave their heads every month. When you shave yourself, you often leave bits. And so you shave the night before the full moon, and we shave, and it's, you think, okay, everything's fine, and then you go to the group meeting on the day of the full moon, and someone points out that you've missed a spot. So it really isn't all that important that you find the perfect teacher. It's important that you find a competent teacher, but you don't have to look at your teacher and think he's got to be enlightened or he's got to be the perfect master or meditator to be able to guide me. You're just looking for someone who can look at your head and see the hair that's still stuck to it. Now, when someone else shaves your head, it's incredibly easy and takes a lot less time, it's a lot safer, and they don't miss a spot. So the same goes with having a teacher, having someone to guide you. This is number three. Number four is tranquility. In order for us to see clearly, we need to first calm the mind down. This is something that I think we may not understand clearly for those people who are set on gaining understanding. They often try to skip the tranquility part. But many of those people who are set on meditating, they haven't thought of the wisdom part, and so they're only set on tranquility. And so in regards to tranquility, I think it's important to point out the flaw in both of these, that you can't expect to gain real understanding without first calming the mind down. And if your intention is simply to calm the mind down but not continue on to gain understanding, then you're missing out on as I said last week, you're missing out on the very pinnacle of existence or the pinnacle of meditation practice. You're missing the whole point, basically. It's like covering up a tuft of grass with a rock or something. And you cover it up for a while, and you take the rock off, and the grass grows back. And so I think many types of meditation actually miss the point on this one, that the point of tranquility is not tranquility for itself, because that's temporary. It's something that arises based on the effort that you put in. And so there's the reaction. For the action, there's the reaction, and they're based on each other. However much effort you put into your meditation, so much tranquility comes from it. But when you give up the effort, then of course the tranquility disappears, and then you've got to start all over right where you started. So in this sense, I'd say there are basic two types of meditation to calm your mind. Of course, there are many types of meditation, but I think they can generally be categorized into two types. That type which is for the purpose simply of tranquility, and that type which is for the purpose of wisdom as well, which we're calming the mind in order to understand something. The first type can take anything as an object, but it would generally take something that is conceptual. This is something that doesn't exist, because of course something that doesn't exist can't give you wisdom and understanding about that which does exist. So we take a symbol or a visualization. Many people will close their eyes and visualize something. It might be a color or a picture or a light, a flame or so on. Many different things that we'll fix and focus on. Sometimes we focus on God, or we focus, in Buddhism, we focus on the Buddha, for instance. And this calms the mind, but it can't possibly give rise to understanding about reality, because it has nothing to do with our everyday real life. So, whereas tranquility is important, it's important to understand tranquility as well, and to understand the purpose. That if we're going to just try to understand things in terms of reading books and studying and trying to live our lives in a way that contemplates and understands things, then at the very best we're going to go very slowly. At the worst, we're not going to get anywhere, and I don't think it's sure that we're going to get any results at all. I suppose we might get some results, but at the same time, we're doing all sorts of bad things and unwholesome things because our minds still have addictions and attachments and aversions. So where it's like taking 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, and that's at best. The tranquility of mind is for the purpose of focusing the mind in the meantime while we still have defilements, to keep the defilements, the unwholesome tendencies in our minds at check, at bay, while we examine them and while we examine the objects of our desire. And when we look at them and when we understand them, then we'll become content, we'll become peaceful, we'll become wise, we'll come to understand these things. So the tranquility which we're trying to focus on is the tranquility focusing on reality. And this is where meditation comes in. When we practice meditation, we're going to focus on something that's real. For instance, most of you, even in real life, are probably sitting down. And when you're sitting, you can feel the different sensations that arise. You can feel what is real in your experience of the things that come and go. So you're sitting here, you can feel the feeling of your body touching the chair. You can feel the sensation of the air touching your abdomen or touching your chest as it rises and ceases. And you can see it coming and going. You can see it arising and ceasing. And so we take that as our object. In the same way as someone else might focus on a concept, We come and we focus on these realities. When the stomach rises, for instance, we just say to ourselves, we have this mantra as like someone who focuses on a concept, we focus on reality. We watch the stomach rising with the breath that comes in. We watch the stomach falling with the breath that goes out, and we just say to ourselves, rising, falling, rising, falling. When we feel the feeling of our body touching the chair, we say to ourselves, feeling, and we just focus on that. And we come to see the things that are associated with it. We sometimes see pain, we sometimes see pleasure, we sometimes have liking, we sometimes have disliking. Maybe we'll be sitting here and you're hearing my voice, or you have other sounds come up. So you're hearing my voice and maybe it sounds very calming and soothing. Someone who has practiced for some time in the art of teaching, you know, can give a talk which makes people happy to listen. So you hear the voice and it sounds nice. Or maybe on the other hand, you don't like what I'm saying. Oh, this meditation sucks. I've tried it before, or it's not nothing compared to my meditation. So it makes you unhappy. Or maybe it makes you happy and then suddenly someone starts yelling in the room next to you. Someone turns on the television or starts playing their music or so on. And so you get angry, you get upset because what you like has been removed, has been destroyed, has been replaced with something else, with something that you don't like. So we're focusing on these things. When we see things, when we hear things, we're just going to say to ourselves, hearing, hearing. We're going to learn all about what is associated with these things. When you like something, say liking, liking. When something makes you angry, instead of immediately reacting and giving rise to suffering, causing suffering for yourselves and suffering for other people, you know, just looking at it and seeing what's going on. You dislike something, say disliking, disliking. When you're angry, say angry, angry. And when there's nothing else, just come back to what there is. Come back to your breath, come back to the feeling of sitting on the chair, come back to the heat and the cold or whatever. Whatever's real, whatever's really there or really happening. This is the concentration, the tranquility which we require to see clearly. As your mind starts to calm down, as you start to focus on the things that are arising clearly, focusing on the experience for what it is, as it is, then there gives rise to insight, which is the fifth important factor in the arising of right understanding. This is the insight that arises. So we talk about right understanding in a general sense, in terms of understanding the way things work. Well, how we understand the way things work is by looking at individual realities. And as we start to see more and more of what makes up reality for what it is, then we get this right view, this right understanding. We say, this is the way reality is. You know, there's many things I haven't experienced, but everything I have experienced tells me, you know, from empirical realization, that this is the way it is. And so, for instance, as we start to focus on the things which we're attracted to, we see that they come and they go, that they arise and they cease, and there's nothing inherently attractive about them. For instance, we look at the human body. You know, most of us are attracted to one gender or the other, or sometimes both genders. We're very much attracted to the beauty of the human body, when in fact the human body is not a beautiful thing. There's nothing inherently beautiful about it at all. You can ask a dog, you can ask another species of animal, and they're going to tell you that the only thing that's beautiful is their species. And so we can see how arbitrary it is. And if you were to take apart the human body piece by piece, if you say, okay, that person has beautiful hair. Well, let's look at the hair. First of all, when you don't clean it, when you don't wash it all the time, it's something that is actually very unattractive. It smells, it gets oily. But regardless, it's not something that's inherently beautiful. It's like a string that's stuck in the scalp, like a creeper that has grown in the top of the scalp, and it grows out of the oil and the, you know, amidst the oil and the dead skin on the top of our heads. If we say this person's skin is beautiful, well, let's look at the skin. What is skin like? If we don't wash it, it's putrid. It smells. It's oily and it's flaking and so on. But irregardless of that, it's something that is just used as a covering to keep the blood and the fluids and everything else inside. And if it gets scraped, we can see the blood coming out. It changes color when we're sick, and it expands and contracts, and it bruises and so on. There's nothing incredibly beautiful about these things. This is just as an example. It's a very clear and potent example that, in fact, what we're dealing with is our formed idea about these things, what we have developed over time, our conditioned response to these things. It's a case of conditioning, where we see that these things bring us happiness again and again from lifetime to lifetime. And so we create this reality, in our minds that this is something that's beautiful. And as we look at these things closely, so many things we're going to do away with. We can leave aside very difficult things like the human body, and we can look at obvious things like the addiction to hurting other people, or our desire to hurt other people. For when someone says something nasty to us, we want to turn around and hurt them. And we can see how horrible that is. When someone does something we don't like, maybe they didn't even intend to, and we get angry. A really good and clear example of this is when we stub our toe or hurt ourselves on something inanimate, and then we fling the object across the room, or we kick it, or we yell at it, or we curse and we shout. We get angry at something that has no feelings, that had no intention, obviously, of hurting us. And we know how stupid it is. But we have this desire to lash out as though that's somehow going to help us. In the past, that's the conditioning that we've gained. We think when someone hurts us, we hurt them back. And for a time, we win. We feel happy. We feel good. And it creates this cycle of revenge that inevitably leads to just more and more suffering until one side eventually gives up. And as we start to see these things, at the very least, we start to give up the very, very coarsest of our defilements. We start to give up our anger. We start to work very hard, and we say, no, this is the wrong way of approaching these things. These things are not beneficial. And there's nothing wrong with what this person did to me, and there's nothing wrong with my situation now. And we're able, our ability to let go and give up and be free. This is the understanding that arises. This is the insight that we gain when we look at things clearly. As we watch our emotions, for instance, when we're angry, normally we say, okay, I've got to go hurt that person or do something about this. That's our reaction to the anger. We change that to just simply reacting as if it were what it is. When there's anger, we know that there's anger. We say to ourselves, angry, angry, or anger, anger. Just knowing it for what it is. We say, this is anger, so I know it as anger. Not, this is anger, so I have to go and hurt someone. It's my anger, and I'm angry, and so on. The attachment to self. Us and them, me and you, and so on. Good and bad. And the same with things that we're attracted to. When we like something and we need something, and we're always chasing after it, even though we know it's bad for us, we're able to do away with that. We're able to come and see things, that these things are really not attractive. They're not beneficial. We see things for what they are, and we become bored of this constant search, this constant chasing after things that we don't need and that don't really improve our state of being, our state of mental health, mental well-being. That don't really bring us happiness. So these are the five things which the Lord Buddha said contribute to the attainment of right view or right understanding, and help to do away with wrong view and wrong understanding. Seeing things not for what they are, seeing things for something other than what they are, and for the arising of, this is for the arising of happiness and for the removal of suffering. So I'd like to thank everyone for coming today. I think I'll just go right into the questions and answers now. If you have any questions, I'm happy to give you answers. And then after that, we'll wrap up. So thanks for coming again. And I'll answer questions now via text.